industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
I'm happy to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Roger Rothenberg. He completed his residency training in emergency medicine at Cooper Hospital, and he will soon complete his fellowship in medical toxicology at the New York City Poison Center before accepting a faculty position at Temple Hospital in Philadelphia.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, Adam. Today, we are going to talk about the color blue and a medicine that is quite blue. Before we start, I have no financial disclosures, and I used no generative AI or large language models in the creation of this presentation. I'm going to start off with a kind of ridiculous question. What color is the sky? Right, we would say it's blue, obviously. That's our word in English for the perception of a field of photons with a wavelength somewhere at 430 to 500 nanometers. Now that's an arbitrary term, right? The wavelengths are continuous. We could choose to slice them up any way that we wanted. Ultimately, the purpose of our words for colors is to categorize or distinguish things in the environment. As a language changes over time, if there's something that is rare, you don't see it very much, or there's no benefit to really pointing it out, there may not be a word for it. So the English word blue, it didn't really mean what it means now before about the 1200s. And that's basically when Europe started to use many more blue dyes. So if you were to ask Homer of the Odyssey, not the Simpsons, he might say that the sky is bronze colored. And he did describe it that way. That's actually the word used in those epics. In fact, early Greeks didn't have a word specifically for blue. It kind of could fall, if it was dark blue, under their word for dark colors, or if it was light blue, under their word for lighter colors. And early civilizations had a similar color scheme. Generally, white, black, and red are the first color words that tended to develop, because these were the pigments that were available and because these were the helpful things to distinguish in the environment. This is one of the more famous examples of cave art found in modern France, thought to be around from 15,000 BCE. One theory of language development is that words for color develop sequentially over time as the language evolves. And part of this is probably biological. The cones in our eyes, those are the structures that detect color, essentially. 98% of them are the two on the right depicted here, attuned to red and green. Only 2% are on the left and really able to distinguish blue. And it makes a lot of sense to distinguish between light and dark, day and night. It makes sense to see the color red, the color of blood, the color of the tasty or poisonous red berries or apples or tomatoes. But it's much more rare for the color blue to be really salient in nature or in life, especially in earlier civilizations. Except for the sky, which is arguably blue, there are a few natural blues out there. But the quest for blue and blues led ultimately to the discovery of kind of miraculous toxicologic antidote that is still in use today that I'm going to get to eventually. lapis lazuli was one of the first sources of blue pigments for people. It's a semi-precious metamorphic rock, mostly found in the region that today we would call the Middle East. Very pretty, but impure, with these streaks of kind of yellow in it, rare and hard to get a pure blue out of it. Still, many cultures did use this color early on, but not so much in Europe. Vermeer used almost exclusively lapis lazuli for his blues, but again, expensive pigment and not available to everyone. We needed alternatives. Isatis tinctoria, or the woad plant, was the more common source of blue pigments, but it wasn't a very good one. It had a low concentration of the actual chemical that is responsible for the blue pigment from plants, and that's indigo. Woad was used by the early Germanic peoples and the Celts pretty extensively, but they were considered barbarians by the Romans, who were the dominant culture in Europe at that time. And the color blue became kind of guilty by association with them. In fact, individuals with blue eyes were considered untrustworthy in Roman society around the first century current era. Getting blue out of these was very labor intensive too. The leaves had to be plucked, crushed into paste, cured for weeks, and then concentrated. That paste, incidentally, was called pastel. And that's where the word pastel comes from, that meaning broadened out to mean any light-colored pigment. But that kind of gives you a sense of how vivid the blue you could get from woad was, which is not very. By the 1200s, there was enough technology to start producing a blue dye on an industrial scale, and it became more common, and it became popularized by initially the French monarchy, and then spread throughout Europe. And it took on connotations of nobility and joy and peace. And there's a chicken and egg question about the rise in the popularity of the color after that, but it became quite popular. Interestingly, dyers and the pigment producers making blue had a kind of rivalry with the ones making red, which was the more popular color before blue supplanted it. And this red-blue rivalry or dichotomy is still present in modern culture. It was a big feature of the Protestant Reformation, where blue was kind of promoted as a less, you know, less indulgent symbol. We, of course, have modern day Democrats and Republicans, red and blue, the original Game Boy Pokemon, red and blue. And then, of course, some modern American, particularly West Coast gang affiliations represented by rivalry between red and blue. This is a block, essentially, of concentrated indigo pigment, and that's indigo in molecular form on the right. Indigo is still used. It's the blue in blue jeans and much of the colors that we wear today and that we use. But woad is not a great way to get it. A much better way, as you might imagine from the name of the chemical that we're talking about, is from indigo. This is indigo for a tinctoria. It gets that name because it was mostly found or indigenous to India. It has a much higher concentration of indigo than woad. And by the 1700s or so in Europe, woad really fell out of favor and cultivation of indigo was preferred. Now, it was still quite expensive, up until the colonization of the Americas, where a variety of indigo was discovered and could be cultivated and processed inexpensively through slave labor. Newton's discovery of the spectrum of light as refracted through prisms really continued to popularize the color blue and change the entire conception of color. This is what led to Goethe and Romantic artists eventually taking on blue as the association with the feelings of melancholy, and that later led to the naming of blues music. But indigo still is not very stable, it's hard to extract, it fades over time, so there were efforts to find a better blue. And ultimately, in 1876, a German chemist, Heinrich Caro, was the research director of a dye company called BASF. He was experimenting with aniline. Now, aniline is a chemical that actually was originally produced from indigo. We have better ways to make it now. But aniline was a molecule that's very reactive and very able to be manipulated. So this kind of early organic chemist was trying to make new pigments and made a few that are still used today. But among them was the one that I'm showing here, methylene blue. Incredibly vibrant. Incidentally, the company BASF would merge with other German chemical companies and produce a different compound with a blue association, and that's hydrogen cyanide, also known as Zyklon B, which was used horrendously as a chemical asphyxiant for the mass executions of the Holocaust. But the vividness of methylene blue really let people's imaginations run wild. The germ theory of disease was just starting to be explored and developed. And there was the thought that methylene blue it's such a brilliant, vivid blue. Could it reveal something about the microscopic world? And indeed, it did. Robert Koch here, who is a contemporary of Pasteur and one of the founders of modern bacteriology, proved the existence of the tuberculosis bacterium by staining it with methylene blue. And this is his plate on the right. So this was evidence for the germ theory of disease. Now, the kind of logical conclusion of this dye is able to be taken up by these microorganisms, might it preferentially harm them too? And so it began to be used as a sort of experimental therapy of various disease states. And thus, methylene blue is the first ever synthetic drug used in medicine because it can be produced from aniline, which, you know, though it can be extracted from indigo, can also be independently synthesized from benzene. So over the next 50 or so years, people were throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. So the infectious states make sense based on the concentration of the blue pigment, but the kind of use expanded and people tried using it to treat cyanide poisoning and carbon monoxide poisoning. Didn't really work. But eventually we got lucky and it hit its mark. So in 1933, it was a student working with aniline dye, incidentally, which is the molecular structure shown in this slide. He got a headache. His skin changed color into what's described in this paper as a sort of mauve lavender, but a color that today we would call cyanotic or blue. He also had a very altered mental status and looked quite gravely ill. So given the popularity of methylene blue for cyanide and carbon monoxide, which this patient's condition didn't quite fit, but it wasn't really clear to them what was going on with him, they tried giving him a gram of methylene blue through an IV. He immediately, within the hour, improved drastically, went from looking like he was on the verge of death to being a fairly normal guy, although he may still have had a blue tint from the methylene blue itself. And we were off to the races with this. We have a very good antidote for this condition. What is this condition? I'll just briefly touch on it. Methemoglobinemia is the term for it. It's fundamentally oxidation of the iron in hemoglobin leading to its inability to carry oxygen. So we need hemoglobin to transport oxygen from the air to our lungs, to our tissues, and methemoglobin is unable to do that. So depending on how much you have, it's effectively, you have no blood. It can be acquired, as from the student with aniline dyes, or there are some heritable methemoglobinemias. This is a depiction of Martin Fugate in 1800s Kentucky, who went on to produce a blue lineage. As I said, these patients look quite sick and they have an oxygen saturation that is stuck right at 85% usually, no matter how much extra oxygen you might give them through the face mask. They don't need oxygen, or at least not oxygen by breathing it in. They need to be able to use their oxygen, and most of the time they need methylene blue. Methemoglobin has been responsible for several outbreaks throughout history. There are a number of ways you can get it, among them sodium nitrite. One incident in the 1950s led to 11 individuals becoming inadvertently poisoned by sodium nitrite and showing up to various hospitals looking blue and very, very ill. Ruscha writes the really incredible story of the medical detective work that led to the identification of this condition and the ultimately tracing it back to the place where it had occurred. And the reason for it was that the nitrite had fallen into the salt. So over the last 100 years, there have been many, many cases of methemoglobin treated with methylene blue. It has become a staple toxicologic antidote. There are some unfortunate iatrogenic issues with administering it sometimes, although it seems to be fairly safe. The data is quite lacking overall. It's all case reports, like I said, that led to this self-plug here, where I and some of my excellent mentors went through 20 years of poison center data to look at patients who developed methemoglobin and who were treated with methylene blue to kind of better characterize outcomes and how well does it work. Well, it works incredibly well. 98% of our 180 something patients who got it immediately improved. Surprisingly, one of the biggest culprits of the induction of methemoglobinemia was alkyl nitrites, also known as poppers, which are sold legally, but with the implicit purpose of being used as a recreational substance, meant to be inhaled, produces euphoria and smooth muscle relaxation. The issue is it's in this little bottle with a lightning bolt right next to the 5-hour energies in your New York bodegas. So we saw quite a number of patients who had erroneously drank this substance and became quite ill from it, but fortunately were well treated with methylene blue. Now, methylene blue has resurged in this new era of pseudoscience and social media grifting. Depicted here is a well-known politician ostensibly dropping methylene blue in his glass because it is promoted non-specifically as a health supplement for energy, for cognition, for which there is no evidence whatsoever. Let me be clear. There is no evidence that outside of the treatment of methemoglobinemia, methylene blue will provide a meaningful benefit to you. What's more, we do know that methylene blue in very large doses can, for biochemistry reasons that I really don't have the time and I think the audience probably has no desire to hear, but it can produce methemoglobinemia in large doses, and it is orally bioavailable. We typically give it intravenously. We almost always in the hospital give it intravenously, but it is orally bioavailable. So you could potentially get toxic from this. Now, this is just an example. I found a 50 milliliter bottle of 1% methylene blue. If you drank the whole thing, that would be about 6 milligrams of methylene blue per kilogram of weight, assuming you're about 70 kilos. Now, this is right on the border of the initial toxic dose of methylene blue that was determined back in the 30s when it started becoming popular. Now, it's not very toxic, but it can produce a methemoglobinemia up to 15% of your hemoglobin or so, which is enough to turn you blue, but if you're not anemic, probably will not make you gravely ill. This is a case report just illustrating the potential harm of methylene blue in those who don't need it. So while it is a truly amazing molecule with a beautiful, brilliant blue color, I cannot advocate for the consumer use of it. So that concludes my talk. I thank you all for your time and your attention,